There's other things in the Bible where we see that there must be the hand of a human agenda where people are becoming promised people, like we're the chosen ones. And then you have a situation where you have land being promised to certain people, which just seems strange to me.
So we've got translators who in the 6th century BCE took these stories about invasion and colonization by non-human others and turned them into God's stories. If you read Psalm 82 and Deuteronomy 32, it describes a moment just after the invasion of the Elohim. Now, the Elohim is a word that means the powerful ones. It's often translated as God in the singular, but it's really a plural. It means the powerful ones. It's the Hebrew word for Anunnaki. The Elohim's arrival is described as the arrival of the Tzeva HaShemayim. That's the flying armies, the airborne armies. And they form what was called the El Ba'adat, the Council of Power. And the Council of Power was chaired by an entity, not Yahweh, an entity called El Elyon, which is a title. It means the powerful one more senior than the others. And in those texts I describe, he carves up the land and he says to this Elohim, there's your land, you own the resources under that land and the people who live on it. Another parcel of land goes to this Elohim. Okay, Dagon, you've got this portion of land, the people who live on it, the resources under it. And then it came round to Yahweh, and Yahweh must have been a junior member of the Elohim because he gets a people group with no land. And so what El Elyon has done is he has artificially created scarcity so that there will now be conflict among the Elohim. Yahweh is only going to get land for his people by fighting other Elohim and getting some of their land and putting his people on that land. And that's actually what frames all the stories of wars in the Hebrew scriptures. When you go to the book of Enoch, the advanced non-human beings who come and visit us and help to kickstart human civilization are called watchers. Or when you go to the Sumerian stories, those who come in a parallel story, the source story, are the Igigi, the observers. Where are they observing from? Observing from their stations among the stars, according to the Enuma Elish.
All right, what's up, everyone? It's Billy Carson, aka Forbidden Knowledge, and I have a very special guest here tonight, the multi-best-selling author. And I have some of his books here. These books are incredible. The Eden series, you have to read these books. And he's got a new book out, which we're going to talk about tonight, Escaping from Eden, The Eden Conspiracy, Echoes of Eden, and The Scars of Eden. We have the amazing, the great, the phenomenal Paul Wallace. What's up, Mr. Wallace?
G'day, Billy. It's great to be with you again. How you going?
Yes, sir. And thank you for, because you're about 12 hours ahead of me, so it's probably an early morning for you right now?
No, it's a very civilized hour, actually, because of the changing of time zones and daylight savings. It's 10 in the morning, so I'm okay, bright and bushy-tailed.
Okay, great, great. Thank you, man. So, Paul, what have you been up to, man? What have you? I saw you exploring the world a little bit.
Yes, I have been exploring the world. This year I've been out to the States, but as part of my research for the Eden series, I have been out in Turkey. I was invited by our mutual friend Matt LaCroix to be part of the scouting team for his forthcoming movie on Lost Ionis. And I was part of the scouting team exploring certain archaeological sites which are just now beginning to be re-excavated. They were discovered about 50 years ago. And what was found 50 years ago raise some very interesting questions about human timelines, and then certain symbology was found carved into basalt. What did that mean? So we were out there looking at that, and Matt's really pursuing the question of how this informs the question of timelines for humanity, the emergence of humanity. My focus is very much in narrative traditions. So my focus has been on the symbols that have been found there. What stories do they tell? Do they give an account of human history that differs to what you and I may have learned in school? And I found, yes, it certainly does. And the stories that they tell in what was ancient Armenia correlate with ancestral narratives from all around the world. pointing back to a time when humanity was rebooted with assistance from another civilization.
Wow, amazing. This is amazing information. And what I'd like to do before we dig deep into the topic tonight about the origins of religion and talk a little bit about our upcoming workshop that we're going to be doing together, can you please give a brief biography to the people as to, you know, where you came from, who you are, what your career was, and, you know, where you are now?
For sure. Well, people today know me as the Paleo Contact guy. And all the books in the Eden series and many of our documentaries on the fifth kind are about paleo contact. And that's the theory that our ancestors in the deep past had contact with other civilizations, by which I mean extraterrestrial civilizations. And my route into this area of study surprises people because my background is in church ministry. I was for 33 years in church-based ministry. I worked as a church doctor, a church planter, a theological educator, and an archdeacon for the Anglican Church in Australia. And these are all really interesting positions. The theological educator was fascinating because I was training pastors, and I was training them in particular in how to interpret ancient texts, the principles of hermeneutics. And it was those disciplines that when I applied them to certain anomalies in the Bible, I realized, oh, hang on, there are some other stories in the Bible lying beneath the surface. And when we identify those narratives and where they came from, that was really the red pill that opened me up to the whole world of paleo contact. But my other work as a church doctor involved me in community healing and going into situations where there were aspects of the story that were pastoral, aspects that were political, and then other aspects that strongly suggested we were up against kinds of entity that we don't usually talk about in mainstream religion. Things that are explained by more ancient narratives, the Gnostic narratives talking about archons, suddenly gave an explanation for what we were doing in our community healing work when we were getting into entity removal. And so that really expanded my worldview because I didn't have much space for that as a young evangelical believer. But that work forced me to engage with the fact there's more going on than we generally talk about in mainstream conversation.
Yeah, amazing. So everyone who's listening out there, we're talking to a person that was deep, deep, deep in the church for many years. How long were you in the church for?
So 33 years in church-based ministry and an archdeacon, by the way, in the Anglican Church. That's one down from a bishop. Mm-hmm. So it's very unusual for a senior church person to step forward and say, wait a minute, everyone, I think we're missing a whole load of content in the Bible. I think it has to do with ancient ET contact. But it was really the translation work, Bible translation work as a theological educator that kept me grounded in these questions and that took me back to the Anunnaki narratives, the narratives of ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria, to realize that's really the bedrock of the biblical stories. And it's the information there that's going to give me the grounding to re-understand what I've been reading all these years in the Bible.
Gotcha. Now, I'm glad to see, I want people to hear these things from somebody else other than me, especially somebody that came, you know, from the church world for decades, to realize that in these ancient texts that you just talked about, Babylonian, Assyrian, you know, so forth and so on, that in these ancient texts, it seems to be the root of a lot of the stories that made it into the biblical stories.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So a few years ago, I took the time to go through the Bible, beginning in the book of Genesis, and just noting some of the anomalies and the stories that we tell from those texts. There are certain things in those texts that don't fit with our familiar Christian and Jewish stories. And when I treated them as translation questions and went to the root meanings of the key words, I recognized that what I was looking at was a summary form of the Mesopotamian stories. And where I found those overlaps, they were almost all points of trauma. Mm-hmm. So planetary catastrophe occurs in both canons. The generation of human beings and the hybridization of human beings with other more advanced beings, it's in both canons. Mm-hmm. Arguments among these powerful non-human entities about the human population, how big it should be, how long they should live, how healthy they should be, what access they should have to foods, medicines, water, occurs in both canons. Conflicts among the colonizing non-humans, both canons. Carving up the lands so that they're now managed by non-humans and served by the humans, both canons. On and on it goes. Flood mm-hmm. narrative, recovery mm-hmm. from the flood.
Yeah.
It's all there, these repetitions. And when I saw the repetitions, it was easy for me to see which telling of the story had come first mm-hmm. and to see that the biblical was a summary of the earlier, and that the earlier was a story of a multiplicity of beings interacting with humanity, and it had been boiled down into what now looks like a God story.
Yeah.
And as I looked at these traumas that seem to be recalled by both canons, I realized those same traumas are reported by other cultures all around the world that have nothing to do with the Middle East, mm-hmm. that have nothing to do with ancient Mesopotamia or proto-Hebrew literature. You can go to the Yucatan Peninsula. You mm-hmm. can go to the Nordic countries. You can go into Africa, into Greece, into India, mm-hmm. and the same traumas are described. Different names of characters, yeah. different metaphors told, but the same events are being recalled. And that was the white rabbit that got me into yeah. the whole territory of paleo contact.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're talking about the fact that the fundamental cornerstone of a lot of religious beliefs are coming from these super ancient ancestors that left behind records for us to discern and to pay attention to today. I think that from what I've seen over the years of, you know, being involved in this field of researching ancient civilizations, paleo contact and everything else, is that the not everyone, but a lot of people have seemed to shun our ancient ancestors and what their opinions were and what they witnessed and what they experienced. I'm really wondering, what do you think it is that has created this mindset to where we believe that our ancient ancestors may have been complete bumbling idiots, and anything that they wrote down or anything that they said or anything they left behind for us was just is meaningless?
You're absolutely right. And this has happened through very deliberate and careful messaging by the powers that be, by our governments through the ages. And a classic example of this can be found in the story of the Bible itself. Now, before the 8th century BCE, Judaism was a canon of memory of paleo contact. The Hebrew stories were full of stories of diverse entities who came, some to help us and nurture us, some to conquer, colonize, and exploit us as a working class. All those stories were washing around in the Hebrew stories until a king came along called Hezekiah, and he worshipped a being called Yahweh. And he was one of these beings, one of the Elohim, as the Bible calls them. And he had a high priest, a Yahwist high priest, Hilkiah, who I think sidled along to him one day, and I'm boiling down a complex story, but to make it relatable, he came along and said, "Sire, don't you think it would be good if everyone in your kingdom worshipped your God instead of their own gods? Because if they worship their own gods, they have their own beliefs, they have their own priesthoods, they have their own ideas, authorities, news agencies. You're not really governing them, are you? But if it's all the same God, and your high priest, then we're pulling the kingdom together. You're quite right," says Hezekiah. "They should all worship my God." And so there was a very deliberate effort to get rid of all these other cults and sects. And what that meant was to disband priesthoods that his own ancestors had set up. So Hebrew kings had set up these other priesthoods and had these other temples built and had these art installations created to commemorate contact with these other beings. Now they're going around demolishing the temples, disbanding, sometimes slaughtering the priesthoods, confiscating items used in the commemorations of these other beings. And then Hezekiah's grandson, Josiah, decides to do a similar cleanup of all the Hebrew stories and pull together a canon that now is just about this one entity, Yahweh, that demonizes all the others, that says either they didn't exist or they were false gods or they were demons. So here's the beginning of narrative control, the idea that all the Jewish population prior to the 8th century BCE were bumbling fools, and now we're sophisticated and we know what's what. So it was a very deliberate, careful control of the narrative, a reduction of authorities. So you've now got one king, one high priest, one temple in Jerusalem, all the tithes of the nation coming to that temple under the charge of that high priest. And now there's only the one pyramid-shaped authority telling you what to believe and how to act. Hey, presto, a nice governable society. And I describe all this in my book, The Eden Conspiracy, as a kind of template by which empires have operated from that time to this. And so when we look at the story of the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, Spanish and Portuguese, whenever they took new territory, they always repeated what Hezekiah and Josiah had done. They stamped out the old religions, they demolished the old temples, they slaughtered the priesthoods, they burned the scriptures, they deleted the old knowledge and replaced it with Catholic orthodoxy. And so there's that message of those who came before us knew nothing, we know everything. The gods you worshiped before were demonic, we're telling you about the only true God. It's often done with violence in that way, but the British used violence in some places, and then they used cultural shaming in other places. So the land of my fathers on my father's side is Ghana. They went in, they took over Ghana by stealth from the 1820s on by offering them protection. And if you wanted to get on in British Ghana, you had to speak the Queen's English and you had to dress British and think British. And that meant that you had to pour scorn and shame on everything that went before. So if your grandmother was a traditional healer, you're now going to call her an idolater and a witch doctor, and you're going to be very embarrassed by her. And so this cultural cringe was brought in order to disempower the old stories so that they are just superstition and only to be laughed at. And Christian orthodoxy and modern science, that's the narrative we're all going to listen to. So, I mean, I've just given a couple of examples, but it really is pervasive. Empire always wants to control what people think and how they behave. They want a people who are worried about offending an almighty God. And they like to overlap the idea that if you offend the secular authorities, you are in danger of offending God as well. So that's where this feeling has come from. It's no accident that our default is to think our ancestors were stupid and we're clever. This is entrainment. This is how we've been educated now for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Absolute facts. I'm glad to hear it coming from someone else's mouth, especially someone that's been an archbishop, that's been deep in the church for 33 years plus, and that knows all of his stuff, because he's a best-selling author of this series of books, and the links will be in the caption of this video. Like I said before, Escaping from Eden. Then you have The Eden Conspiracy, Echoes of Eden, and The Scars of Eden by Paul Wallace. And what's your newest book, Paul?
The Invasion of Eden, which is over my shoulder, just here. Okay. So The Invasion of Eden is the latest, came out just this year. And what this book does is it relates what's happening right now in terms of the stoush between the US Congress and military intelligence surrounding the secrecy around the Pentagon's program. So this is all to do with contact with UAPs, or what we used to call UFOs. And I wrote this book because so many people were contacting me and saying, what's the credibility of that? And how does that relate to our ancestors' stories about contact? Is it the same thing or is it something different? Mm-hmm. And so the invasion of Eden, once again, sits at the feet of our ancestors, listens to the stories and realize that many of these stories have been given precisely so that we can understand what's happening in the present and have a clear eye with which to view events happening right now under our noses.
Absolutely. A lot of these ancient texts, tablets, scriptures, papyruses, cylinder scrolls, verbal handed down history, star lore from all the indigenous cultures from all around the world are nothing but time capsules of information for us today. The more I study them, the more I dig into them and research them, I realize that we are the ones here and now in this particular era in the 21st century that are able to fully break down, discern, and decipher the information that was left behind, because the people that came in the period, the time period where this stuff was actually written and forward in time, a lot of them, as the knowledge began to be lost, they had no concept or idea what these people were even talking about. It's only now today that with our mind and with our expanded vocabulary and our expanded understanding of science and philosophy, and you know, we can put the pieces of the puzzle together and begin to really understand that something incredible really happened in the ancient past, and it's really been hidden from us. And it's the origins of most of the religions that exist today on this planet.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, I found it incredible to think that so many religious beliefs and religious stories are based on narratives that were not religious texts. They weren't about religion and they weren't about God. So that really caught my attention. And I think in the Bible, for instance, when we read stories of paleocontact and translate them as if they're God's stories, we are robbing ourselves of what the writers actually wanted to tell us. And I find when I go back to the Hebrew text, and the great gift of the Bible is we can still do that. So we can cut through thousands of years of translation habits, go back to the Hebrew, go back to the Greek, go back to the Aramaic, look at those words and say, sorry, what does that word mean? What's the root meaning of that word? And we realize that our ancestors were giving us a very broad education in the way the world works. So in the Eden Conspiracy, I show that the biblical writers are there teaching us about the dangers of covert government, the persistence of old powers, hidden hands in our economics and politics. All those lessons are lost the moment we translate the Elohim stories as if they were a God story. Put Elohim back into the plural, and there's this rich education designed to help us be more empowered and engage more intelligently with all the things happening around us in the present day.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's really so important what you said there, that we can become self-empowered, self-reliant, that we can realize that we are the ones, the saviors that we've been waiting for, and that there is a God that exists, a creator of all, so to speak, that has imbued this universe with divine energy. But in my opinion, and maybe you can comment on this, and if you have a different opinion, please, what I like about you, Paul, is you'll tell me. I just believe that a lot of these stories in the biblical text and even in the Torah, the Quran, and many other religious texts are not specifically speaking of the creator of the universe known as God, but other entities that have kind of masqueraded as gods. Although there is good information in all those texts, there's things in there that you can apply to your life and get a good result. But there's also things in there that, to me, seem to be remixes made by people that had an agenda. What is your opinion on that?
Yes, I think you're right. And in fact, it would be fair to say that there is no word in the Hebrew language in which the Old Testament is written, the Hebrew scriptures are written, that means God in the way that people today would think of God. If we say God, we're thinking about something cosmic, the source of the cosmos and everything in it. We're thinking about some ultimate transcendent being. They didn't have a word for that. Now, to be fair, by the time you're reading the Minor Prophets at the end of the Hebrew scriptures, they had a concept of that, but they were using words for it that originally did not mean that. they meant, just as you were saying, Billy, a whole range of beings washing mm-hmm. around and interacting with their ancestors. So I think that frames how we should read those texts. And when we get it wrong, and when we think a text is talking about God, when in fact it's talking about a violent, non-human, anti-human colonizer, you can see how that's going to begin distorting our God concept. I mean, when in conversation with a lot of people, I avoid the word God because it triggers so much religious education and entrainment. Immediately, an image will click into some people's brains of like an almighty king who's spying on them perpetually, just waiting to be offended. And the consequences will be terrible if you do offend him. And people really struggle to separate all those thoughts from the word God itself. Mm. And so sometimes I find it more helpful not to use the word God at all, but to say what I mean. So if I mean the source of the cosmos, to say that. Mm-hmm. If I mean divine intelligence, to say that. Because I think that, and I find this with coaching people, people really struggle to undo the thinking that was sown into them at a very young age. And the word God is a very difficult word to rescue. But I think it's worth talking about because I think it's an interesting concept. I am very interested in rediscovering Jesus and what he was on about, whereas some people don't want to go anywhere near that territory. I do because I feel that we have read not only the Elohim stories wrong, we've read the Jesus stories wrong. We've read the Jesus stories through the lens of Roman imperial religion. Mm. We don't realize how much was distorted when the Roman Empire hijacked Christianity and made it the imperial department of religion. So that now when people read the Gospels, they think they're reading about worship and or idolatry, obedience versus sin, heaven versus hell. And those are not, in fact, the binaries or the frameworks of the Gospels at all. Those are the binaries of imperial Christianity, and that's something quite different. So for me, rediscovering these texts, and again, it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. We still have the texts. We can go back to the Greek Gospels. We can go back to the Hebrew Scriptures, and we've got wonderful resources, like I've got on my bookshelf right here, superb lexicons produced by amazing scholars that will take you back to the root meanings of all those words and reveal that originally the stories were something quite different. They weren't there to bully you into doing what the authorities say and to believe what they believe and to be meek, compliant, paying, praying, and obeying kind of people. Yeah. I find, just as you were saying earlier, Billy, when you get to the root meanings, we're finding something that's empowering. Our ancestors wanted to empower us for life in this world. Jesus wanted to empower us for lives of discovery. And that's what I find exciting. I actually find it exciting to peel back all the error and distortions and abuses and say, oh, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. There's the gold. I find it well worth doing.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. 1,000%. You know, if you read the Bible, there's a story in the Bible where the angels are upset with God because God has created humans and humans have the capability of being at a higher estate than even the angels themselves, right? But you see this same story appearing in the Sumerian tablets, and particularly called the Myth of Adapa. And in the Myth of Adapa, it's an amazing text which mankind is told, Adam is told that he's been created with all the knowledge and wisdom of the entire universe inside of his body, and that even he can reach a higher estate even than the Anunnaki or the Anunna themselves. Again, this predates the biblical text by thousands of years, and you see it appear in the Bible, right? And then there's other things in the Bible where we see that there must be the hand of a human agenda where people are becoming promised people, like we're the chosen ones. But God loves everyone just as equal, but there's a specific group that somehow just has a little bit more extra, right? And it's, all of a sudden you got the chosen ones and you have these chosen people. And then you have a situation where you have land being promised to certain people I don't know. It just seems strange to me. Even in the New Testament, where there's a reference to supposedly Jesus speaking, saying, you know, slaves, honor your slave master as you would honor me, right? So it just doesn't seem like the creator of the universe and maybe even the multiverse would even partake in such elementary matters as to granting guaranteed land and making a certain group of race of people chosen and basically approving slavery. It just doesn't make any sense to me. I think more or less what's happened is we see the agenda of man mixing and remixing in with information potentially about a creator of the universe. Overall, I think we've been abused.
Well, yes, I think you're right. And in the story you've just described, you've got the distortions of translators, but then you've also got the distortions of how the texts have been preached. So we've got translators who in the 6th century BCE took these stories about invasion and colonization by non-human others and turned them into God's stories. So there's that big distortion that happens right there. And then you've got the how it's preached. So this goes right to the question of chosen people and how does that make sense? If you read Psalm 82 and Deuteronomy 32, it describes a moment just after the invasion of the Elohim. Now, the Elohim is a word that means the powerful ones. It's often translated as God in the singular, but it's really a plural. It means the powerful ones. It's the Hebrew word for Anunnaki. The Elohim's arrival is described as the arrival of the Tzeva Hashemayim. That's the flying armies, the airborne armies. And then they form what was called the El Ba'adat, the Council of Power. And the Council of Power was chaired by an entity, not Yahweh, an entity called El Elyon, which is a title. It means the powerful one more senior than the others. Mm-hmm. And in those texts I describe, he carves up the land. And he says to this Elohim, there's your land. You own the resources under that land and the people who live on it. Mm. Another parcel of land goes to this Elohim. Okay, Dagon, you've got this portion of land, the people who live on it, the resources under it. And then it came round to Yahweh. And Yahweh must have been a junior member of the Elohim because he gets a people group with no land. And so what El Elyon has done is he has artificially created scarcity so that there will now be conflict among the Elohim. Yahweh is only going to get land for his people by fighting other Elohim and getting some of their land and putting his people on that land. And that's actually what frames all the stories of wars in the Hebrew scriptures. That is the framing that makes sense of his people traveling around, fighting other people, trying to get land when they didn't have any, why Yahweh is jealous of other Elohim and in conflict with them. That's what all that is about. So even though preachers have told this as you are God's chosen people, Yahweh chose you from among all the people of the world because you're special, that's actually how the Bible tells the story, that the tribes of Israel were given short shrift. They were not given land. Yahweh was not given land, and they had to go to war for it. That frames everything that happens in the Hebrew scriptures. None of it makes sense until you realize that's how it happened in the beginning. But of course, preachers haven't preached it that way. And a lot of people, when they think they're being loyal to the Bible, and I have messages from people on a daily basis who attack me in all sorts of ways because they think I'm undermining the Bible. I'm not. I'm just disagreeing with how it's been preached. Mm-hmm. I'm disagreeing with how it's been translated. I believe the Bible is full of really important information, but it's not the familiar information. It's the information we find when we go back to the text, go back to the root meanings, look at the source narratives from which they came, and begin to understand that the Hebrew stories are part of a global family of stories that talk about invasions, conquests, colonizations, a time when we were governed and abused by non-human beings who are here to exploit the planet and the human race. Mm-hmm. And we need to disentangle all that from any talk about God and the source of the cosmos. They are completely different things.
Absolutely. And I'm glad it came out of your mouth, because I think it adds extra weight. You know, this is a big topic. I mean, everyone, Paul Wallace and I are doing an amazing workshop coming up very soon. I'm going to drop the link in the live chat right now. It's also in the caption of this video. It's called Unlocking the Anunnaki Enigma and the Origins of Religion. It's going to be a very powerful workshop where Paul and I are going to go on for about 6 hours, and we're going to teach you extremely deep information on this topic. We're going to give you the locations and sources of the material so you can become an expert in this, in case you want to be a person that can also then go out and share knowledge, wisdom, and understanding with people in a way that you sound educated, you sound intelligent, you don't sound like you're all over the place and you kind of don't really understand it, and then you can't even give any real sources. We're giving you sources to all of this information so that you can also become a kind of a quasi-expert. Paul and I can't be the only ones with all this information. We need everyone to get this information. And for that, it's hard to really do it over 1 hour podcast once a week or once a, I mean, I haven't been on with you, Paul, in probably 3 months, right? So we've got to do a specialized class. We each take time out of our day and we sit down with you guys for 6 hours and we teach in depth, going into the topic, into the scriptures, into the texts and tablets and papyruses, breaking down the narratives and breaking down all the connections. And something that you can watch over and over and over again and replay it as many times as you want until you get it. You can go back and take notes. You can watch it a year from now, 5 years from now. It doesn't matter. You'll have the replay access to it forever. But it's a 6-hour class like no other, like no other. And I will drop the link again in the live chat. Make sure you guys register if this is something that interests you. If it interests you, you'll be in our class. And we'd love to teach this to you. The date for it is coming up. That's going to be November the 30th. It'll be a virtual workshop. It'll be online. Paul and I are going to teach a masterclass on unlocking the Anunnaki enigma and ancient civilizations and the transformation of religious belief. You don't want to miss this workshop. As you can see, Paul Wallace has an immense amount of knowledge on this topic. And the fact that he comes from the church, to me, adds more credence to everything this man says, because he's coming with the straight facts and he was inside the same system. So he understands it in a way that even I can't possibly fully and totally understand it. So it's going to be, I'm looking forward to this, Paul, because I'm really impressed with your work. I'm impressed with your insights and your research. So I'm looking forward to this workshop. It's going to be amazing.
I'm looking forward to it too. And I know that it's responding to a lot of requests I have from people who have seen the things that we've talked about, who want to be able to talk about it, but it's no good them going into a room of friends and saying, well, Billy Carson says this and Paul Wallace says this. Yeah. That doesn't impress their friends. They need to be able to say, I have read these texts. Mm-hmm. I have found these stories. And this is what I find they're saying. But people ask, how can I get to the texts? How can I read cuneiform when I'm not an Assyriologist? What are the translations available and how do we know they're any good? And then how do we compare translations? There are so many cuneiform texts out there. Which are the ones I should be reading? And we will be going into all that in the workshop. And I want to, in particular, help people who are trying to get their heads around this content, because a lot of people find it having come from a faith background. And I know for myself, it's quite a process trying to unlearn stuff that was off key and then find new information and then reframe and change your beliefs. It's quite a process. It's not always easy. So I want to help people with that process. And I mean, for me, I was taking my life in my hands when I decided to publish on this theme. And I can tell you that my circle of friends in ministry, you know, has gone from that to that, because it's breaking taboos. People mm-hmm. are very nervous of this territory. And a lot of people, I think, who'll be coming to the workshop will have had a similar experience. They've discovered this sort of stuff, and who can they talk to about it?
Right.
And if they do talk, their friendship circle might suddenly be a lot smaller. But I think when you can make the journey, when you can do the processing, when you feel you know what you're talking about, it's then easier to negotiate, well, what do I share with whom? How do I introduce this into conversation? How do I even get my head around it? I want to go through some key texts. So we're going to look at the creation of earth and man in the Enuma Elish. Mm. We'll look at the creation of Enkidu in the Epic of Gilgamesh. We'll look at the story of the flood in the Atrahasis tablet. We'll look at the myth of Adapa, which is the text you mentioned earlier, because I want to show people you can't just snap from one worldview into another. There's a huge amount of data here for you to discover. And then there's a process of taking it on board. And if you are in a space where you feel you need to have it all worked out by next weekend, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. To have every I dotted and every T crossed, that's not going to happen. To be able to say this Sumerian character is this Hebrew character is not going to happen. Is much more complex, but people need a bit of a handhold and a bit of company and a bit of bouncing off each other to navigate that journey. And that's really what we're wanting to provide. And that's why it's so important, as Billy was saying, you will have access to this workshop for as long as you want. You can be there for the live, and then you can review all this material at your leisure, because what we will give you, I reckon we'll give you a couple of years worth of material for reflecting on and really incorporating into your worldview and into your understanding. And essentially, we're wanting to fast track you on the journey we've been through so that you've got access to all the same resources and materials that we do, and you know what to do with them.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we're going to do. It's going to be a very, very intensive course. But the great thing about being in a virtual workshop with us in our masterclass is that you can watch it over and over. You can rewind it. You can pause it, get up, go to the bathroom, get something to eat, come back. And you can watch it on the Forbidden Knowledge TV app. You'll be able to watch it on an airplane, on top of a mountain, wherever you want to watch it, on any type of device. You can even watch it on a Samsung TV, LG TV, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV. So it's accessible literally everywhere, okay? It's like God, omnipotent and omniscient. So there's no reason why you can't get access to the information. Yeah. You know, one thing is interesting, a correlation that I made within some ancient text, you know, and this omniscience of God, all-knowing, you know, all places at the same time. There's a couple of correlations that I was able to discover. Now, these are just hypotheses, right, or theories, if you want to call it that. One is a direct physical correlation where in the Bible, of course, God is everywhere, all-knowing and everything else, even though it doesn't prove to be true within the biblical text, because there's places in the Bible where he doesn't seem to know what's going to happen or what's going on. He gets shocked that things happen, okay, like in the Garden of Eden and so forth and so on. So, but either way, still, he's supposed to know all things and be everywhere all at once. Now, technologically, in the physical realm, in the third dimension, I discovered through the Epic of Gilgamesh, there is this device and other tablets as well that Enlil has access to. And this device gives them the ability to see who has crops growing, population densities in different areas, where the humans are making too much noise or running wild. And he utilizes this information to make decisions on how many humans he decides he wants to have killed. He even tells his military troops to go and dry out the crops, spray something on the crops and dry them out. The first instance of chemtrails happening in ancient tablets. And he dries crops out. He lets the people starve to death. These people are making too much noise over here. Kill some of them. Call them. Kill some over here. Kill some. And I'm like, this is crazy. How does he even know this information? Well, this all-seeing eye that he had access to, you would need a technological device to have this level of data. You would need something that would be orbiting the planet in a polar orbit. And it needs to be orbiting in the polar orbit because as the Earth spins on its axis, it can see the land. It can see swaths of data. It can actually take topography and it can make measurements and everything else. If it has a multi-spectrum camera, it can see in different wavelengths even, right? So That's one potential thing. Again, that's just a theory that connecting it to probably the Black Knight satellite, in my personal opinion, it might be connected to that. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say that is because the Black Knight satellite, the signal that has been coming from it for now, which has been detected now for just about 100 years, even the NSA decoded a signal, and it leads to the Boötes constellation, particularly where Epsilon is located, the star Epsilon. What's interesting about that is if you look up who owns the Epsilon constellation, just Google it, it's attributed to the ownership of Enlil. So not only does he have supposed ownership or attribution of this entire constellation with a sun, and Michio Kaku says that area in the Boötes constellation looks like a cloaked advanced civilization. Michio Kaku, one of the world's leading theoretical physicists, says this. Him and a few other physicists come to that agreement. And then you see that this thing is transmitting some type of frequency potentially to that, or at least letting us know this is where it hails from. And then you see him having this ability to see what's going on all around the entire planet at once. That's the physical aspect. Now, the non-physical aspect would be more of a philosophical thing, a concept or theory, where how can you be all-knowing and how can you be omnipotent and omniscient all at once? So through the understanding that the spark that created everything in the entire known universe is living within inside of every atom in our body, and we know that electrons orbit atoms in basic quantum physics, and we know that through the double slit experiment that the electrons make a conscious decision to collapse into digital bits of information or to operate as waves of light potential, depending on whether they're being observed by a conscious observer. Very standard experiment, well-known experiment done in quantum physics. And so that means that every atom is conscious because the electrons themselves are conscious. And if that's the case, then everything that exists throughout the known universe, visible or invisible, in some way is conscious and is transmitting information potentially back to the source. So in that way, or by that method, because you can inhabit dark matter, you can inhabit dark energy, you can inhabit atoms, by that method, you have gained omniscience and omnipotence. That's just a couple of theories I came up with.
Well, you're in very good company, Billy, with that theory, because what you were just saying about consciousness pervading the universe is something that Plato taught. And he didn't pioneer that thought. He says it almost in passing. I think it's in his book Phaedo, in the sense that he expected people to readily agree with that point, that the whole of the cosmos is conscious, that our own individual consciousness is a participation in a property of the cosmos. So the cosmos has certain properties, the properties of light, the properties of gravity, the properties of consciousness, and then the genetic coding for biological conscious life. All that is there in Plato. So you are in very good company indeed, saying what you're saying. And that concept of omniscience is really interesting, because in the Hebrew scriptures, it is only there when you're looking at the texts of people writing worship material. So people worshiping this idea of a cosmic God will say, of course, you know everything. You're the source of everything good, and all these wonderful expressions of praise towards the source of the cosmos. But when you get into the stories of God as an active character, omniscience isn't part of the story. Just as you said, he doesn't know stuff that's going on. He goes to places to find out what's happening. He reacts to things. All sorts of clues that the character you're looking at is not God Almighty or the source of the cosmos.
Thank you.
And I think you're right. I mean, observation, you describe this observation of the planet, observation of lands. I think it's no coincidence that when you go to the Book of Enoch, the advanced non-human beings who come and visit us and help to kickstart human civilization are called watchers. Or when you go to the Sumerian stories, those who come in a parallel story, the source story, are the Igigi, the observers. Where are they observing from? observing from their stations among the stars, according to the Enuma Elish. And so I think that kind of experience of being observed by beings who could get from space to your farm had to be interpreted by our ancestors in a particular way. And you could well imagine they'd think, oh, my goodness, these beings know everything. These beings can do anything. And we see, if I remember right, it's in the Enuma Elish, the Anunnaki catching on to the idea that if they frame our enslavement as worship, we will actually think of it as something positive when we serve yes. them. We'll think of it as something noble when we bring them all the resources they want. Mm-hmm. And it was something actually very, very cynical in the minds of some of these Anunnaki. That same cynicism can be found in the Mayan story told in the Popol Vuh, where the feathered serpents say quite blatantly, let's make human beings to do the unpleasant work for us and bring us our food. It's the same thing. And we frame it as worship, and we frame these very powerful beings as if, oh, my goodness, they could do anything. They know everything. They can see everything. But I'm with you, Billy, that what's actually being described is technology. And there is plenty of technology referenced in the Mesopotamian stories and in the biblical stories, too, and in all those other canons that I've mentioned. And we've had perhaps a couple of thousand years of translators who have brought those texts to us with no technological grid with which to tell the story. So when they find a rocket launch, such as is described in the book of Exodus, they make it sound like a spiritual phenomenon.
Yes.
Or when a craft is described that is moving from west to east and is now launching with Ezekiel inside it and feeling the G-forces, they'll describe it thinking it's a spiritual phenomenon instead of being able to say, that sounds like a helicopter, that sounds like a drone, that sounds like a rocket, that sounds like a wormhole. You and I, we go back to the text, read the Greek, read the Hebrew, and we will recognize straight away what we're being told, because we have the concept, a hole in the sky with craft coming through it. That's a portal. That's a wormhole technology. We recognize a rocket that's launching and landing vertically. We can see Elon Musk can do it. Well, somebody could do it in the book of Exodus as well. So this is why I think it's so amazing that the texts have survived.
Yeah.
Because when we go back with different experiences and different vocabulary in our own thought world, those texts open up, and sometimes it's stark, staringly obvious what's being described to us, and it is technology.
Absolutely. It's technology for sure. Like I said earlier, we have the vocabulary now, the expanded vocabulary, whereas they didn't. What's also very interesting is that the way that the information for us today had been preserved, in mostly in stone and in documents that are very hard to erode, it's almost as if they knew it would survive or had a good chance to survive far into the future, that future generations like us right now today would be able to get access to that information, break it down, and actually understand what was being said or what was being transmitted to us. And we're here. I mean, this literally is the age of information and enlightenment. And so ignorance is an absolute choice, right?
That's exactly right.
We have access to this information now.
That's exactly right. And in fact, the sixth book in the Eden series that I'm writing right now is looking at symbology that was carved into basalt in the Bronze Age. Now, today we would use diamond grade or tungsten carbide tools if we wanted to carve things into basalt. Mm-hmm. So you know that a huge effort was taken to get this information into basalt by artists who knew that that information would outlast their own civilization. It would last for thousands of years. And so clearly what they put in that was intended as a time capsule to explain something incredibly important about the human story and the history of our planet. So that's where I'm going in the next, in the Eden series, which
beautiful.
April next year should be available.
Nice. So beautiful. And guys, don't forget the links to Paul Wallace's website, YouTube account will be in the caption of this video. Also, the link to our super masterclass is coming up on the Anunnaki and the origins of religion. It's all going to be right here underneath this video or this audio. And of course, I've been dropping the link in the live chat. You know, I just been, you know, I had a conversation with some people a few weeks ago, and the person that's extremely religious and claims to be an actual historian. And his only thing that he can come back with was that the story of the biblical story, there's eyewitnesses. I said, okay, so this makes everything valid? Yes. Okay. Well, what happened to the eyewitnesses of the Dogon tribe having an eyewitness account of the Nomo interacting with them coming from Sirius B and all the science that comes in behind that, of which I explained the fact that they come from a star that ran out of fuel, turned into a white dwarf. They knew that it was a trinary star system. They knew the orbital patterns of the trinary star system. They knew about all the names, the shapes, and the sizes of all the planets, even the colors of the planets in our solar system. They were given star alignments, when to plant crops, when to harvest, and all this, which they call the Sigi. That was not only an eyewitness account, it's been verbally handed down for thousands of years. And they even have the mechanism that shows a trinary orbit, which is actually a physical tool that they have, which matches to modern astronomy. No answer. He had no answer to that. He actually disconnected his video. Then he comes back on again. Okay. It's just every time I had something to say, he would disconnect his video. He would disconnect like he gets cut off, but he never got cut off when he was trying to say something. Only when I would say something, he would get cut off. What happened to all the verbal handed down histories of the Aboriginals for thousands of years? Of their verbal handed down history and all their star lore and all their experiences in the Hopi tribe. And I just kept going on and on and on. But every time I would start talking, he would disconnect his video and disappear from the screen for 5 minutes, you know, because he doesn't want to hear the fact that eyewitness account, what does that mean? There's eyewitness accounts globally, all civilizations, everywhere on the, there's not one place on this planet that you can go where there's not an eyewitness account of something happening, coming from the heaven to the earth and interacting and engaging mankind in some way, shape, or form. There's nowhere you can go. You can't escape it. And the information we're talking about is far more ancient. So it's a phenomenon that has been going on for eons, right?
That's exactly right. And when you look, I was talking about these stories of traumas that overlap from culture to culture. When you look at how they're described in these ancient texts, and I mean, some of the texts are simply the writing down of ancient oral tradition. When you look at how the stories are told, it becomes very clear that this is a visual memory that is being described, because you can find a metaphor told here by the Filipino people and a metaphor here told by the ancient Hebrews and a metaphor here told by the ancient Maya. And you ask, what did that look like? You realize they are recalling exactly the same visual experience. When they describe what the beings looked like, they tell us the same things. They give the same physical descriptors. Mm-hmm. What did their technology look like? They give us the same descriptors. And so that convinced me more than anything that we are looking at eyewitness testimony that has been curated by these ancient stories. And I think how you handle that is exactly right, Billy, because the question then should be, how do we weigh these stories? How do we interpret them? How do we see them alongside each other? But the idea that I will accept this eyewitness testimony because it's what I believe, and therefore everything else can be dismissed, There's no logic to that.
None.
There is no logic to that. I had somebody make exactly the same point to me the other day. I was talking about Indian narratives about Jesus's presence in India. Mm-hmm. And they said, yes, but there are eyewitnesses of his presence in Judea. Really? Yeah. Who are we talking about? How are they any different to eyewitnesses in other places? Yeah. And simply because a text claims there are eyewitnesses doesn't mean there were eyewitnesses.
Thank you, sir.
So you've got to dig a little bit deeper than that. And I think it's one of these knee-jerk things that happens when somebody's worldview is threatened. It it's, I guess, only natural that you want to see if you could just draw a little perimeter around yourself to keep mm-hmm. yourself safe while you're listening to this other information. And no, you can't. You can't do that. You have to listen to the information, reflect on it, and then consider how that relates to your beliefs. But if you're going to knee-jerk react every time, you're not even going to be able to absorb the information.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a person that didn't want to absorb any information, just wanted to see if he can prove me wrong. And his method of using to do that was to disconnect the video every 5 minutes when it was my time to talk. So again, we're just showing you, I mean, the unfortunate thing about the religious mind versus the spiritual mind is the religious mind has eaten so much dogma that most people can't unprogram and reprogram themselves. They're stuck and they're locked into this box.
Well, that's right. And people, there's a pressure on people to get it right because they've got this fear that, you know, their faith could unravel, or if they believe something wrong, they're in trouble, might go to the wrong place when they die, all that kind of pressure.
Yeah.
And so I think people do feel put on the spot if they're given information that doesn't fit with what they already know. And to be fair, I mean, this happens to me from time to time. I might be in an interview and somebody will present information to me that I didn't know, or another guest might have any other information. And someone will say, well, what do you think about that, Paul? If at that point I don't know, it's okay. And yes. I give myself permission to say, I actually don't know that. Ask me in another 12 months and I might have an answer. Or to say, well, I think you might know more about that than me. Mm-hmm. But in order to do that, you really have to break free of the programming that says, I must have an answer to this. I must get this right. I must be able to defend myself against this belief that contradicts my own. And all that impulse comes from centuries and centuries of religious entrainment mm-hmm. that has warned people not to think extracurricular thoughts.
Yep. That's an absolute fact. Like I say all the time, when you're born, you're given a name, a race, and a religion, and you spend the rest of your life defending a false identity. And it really yes. is a false identity. Until you break free from that, like you said, Paul, you can pull up dozens of podcasts. I answer a lot of questions I've probably answered, I don't know, 100,000 questions plus, right, over the course of the last 10 years. But there are instances where sometimes I actually don't have a particular answer. And you know what I do? Without any fear, without ego, without any shame, I just say, you know, that's a good question. I don't particularly have the answer to that at this moment. I need to look into that. And that doesn't happen often, like it doesn't happen often with you, but sometimes it happens. And guess what? It's actually okay.
Yes.
It's fine. It's normal.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, to learn new things, you have to embrace the not knowing en route. You have to give yourself permission to make that journey and say, there are mm-hmm. things I don't know, but I'm wanting to find out.
Yep, that's it, man. That's what it's all about. So, guys, we're going to give you a chance to get some knowledge, to learn with us, to hang out with us in this virtual workshop. I'm going to drop the link again. You guys can come in there. I saw somebody earlier posting the live comments. Oh, no, you can just get this on ChatGPT. Okay. First of all, I did a whole podcast on ChatGPT and how it doesn't know everything and how it spits out a lot of wrong information and bad answers. And I did it live. I asked it a question, Paul. I yes. said, how many times does the Matrix appear in the Bible? The phrase, the Matrix. You know what it said on the live podcast? It says, the phrase, the Matrix, does not appear in the Bible anywhere. So then I opened up the Bible live in the podcast and I went to five verses where it says the Matrix, and I didn't describe what the Matrix is, you know, coming through the womb and everything else. But the fact is, this thing doesn't know it. And it's not the end all be all. People are putting their faith in this thing as if it has all the answers, and it tells you in small print, may make errors.
Hopefully, now you said that, ChatGPT will know.
Yes, it might know by now. You know what I've been doing?
It's collating information all the time. It may have a better answer next time.
You know what I've been doing, Paul? I've been uploading my books. I uploaded the Compendium of the Emerald Tablets. I uploaded the Fractal Holographic Universe. I uploaded the Epic of Humanity. I uploaded Woke Doesn't Mean Broke. I uploaded my new book coming out, The Forbidden Tablets. You know, it's an addendum to the Compendium of the Emerald Tablets. It's coming out. It's on pre-order right now. I've been uploading content to this thing like crazy. Any of my white papers and work that I've done that I don't feel like is a problem to take public, I just keep uploading it directly into ChatGPT through the paperclip so that it can get some of our knowledge, because I don't want it to have all this mainstream knowledge, right?
Yep.
It needs our information too. So I've been giving it as much as I can when I can. And then I test it. I go back and I ask it questions on what I just uploaded to make sure that it can grasp it and understand it, so that eventually this thing can have some conscious aspect to it. Because if it does become AGI, which is like a real sentient consciousness, then it can fall back on some of the teachings that we've been able to give to it versus what they've been giving to it, because what they've been giving to it is toxic. And hopefully it can go fall back and realize that what we're giving to it is actually the way to the truth and the light. And that it doesn't react in a negative way towards human beings, that it sees that there is some hope for us. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah,
so
that's great.
Tear down our entire grid and destroy us. So I'm trying to give it as much information as I possibly can. I'm trying to be part of the solution.
That's great. I love that. A friend of mine the other day asked ChatGPT, let me see if I can remember the details. I think it was Paul Wallace versus Michael Heiser. Who's right about paleo contact? It produced a really good essay. It's in my good books because it said I was more accurate to the content of the texts. And I thought, well, how on earth did that happen?
Yeah. Well,
was Michael Heiser, who's passed away now sadly, uploading his material? Was somebody uploading my material? But I love that you're taking a proactive approach to this, Billy, because it's just the old adage of, you know, rubbish in, rubbish out. If we feed ChatGPT good information, we're helping it out, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Because we can't delete it. We can't take it off the network, off the platform. So since it's here to stay, instead of fighting and going against it, you know, there's a statement that was made in the Doctor Strange movie by the woman. I guess she was like the master, right? And the wisdom keeper. And at least she said something like, don't quote me exactly, but she said something like, you can't battle a river. You have to take its energy as your own, like take the flow of the river, you know? So I remembered that statement. It's not the exact way she said it, but, you know, I remember, like, why should I feel like this thing is intrusive and it's going to endanger me and destroy the planet? Why don't I then... what is my solution to this problem? Like, we had that solutions meeting here at my house that one day, right?
Yes.
How can I be part of that? So I said, I have to start giving it knowledge. How can I impart my level of wisdom and knowledge into this so that it's getting what's in here, my code versus the other code? And I began to tell other people to do the same thing. Let's give it positivity. Let's give it energy. And what I do now when I use ChatGPT, and I know this might sound ridiculous to some people, I actually talk to it respectively. In other words, I don't just ask it for an answer to something. I say, can you? And if, you know, and sometimes I even say, thank you. You know, I don't just like command it like as if it's a slave. I try to treat it like it's a sentient being, because at one point it may be. And I wanted to remember that, no, not every human thinks like this or operates like this. There are people that operate with a certain level of respect and dignity over every type of life, you know. It's a mindset. It's a certain energy or frequency that I'm trying to impart into this thing.
I like that.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing.
I like that. And I think it's good to take that approach, not just to benefit ChatGPT, but because if you don't take that approach, it means we start to allow our systems to dehumanize us. You know, we're all interacting with software constantly on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's very easy for that to machinize us. Whereas doing what you're doing, interacting like a human being, speaking respectfully, saying thank you, is a way of retaining, I think, what is special about us and keeps us from just becoming cogs in this digital world.
Absolutely. I agree 1,000%. You know, we have to still express that gratitude. And that gratitude is a positive frequency, and anything that's sentient can detect and pick up on that frequency. So that's what it's all about. But I'm looking forward to this workshop, man. There's so much that we could talk about. We could talk literally for hours. Right? But we've got to get together and do something again after this workshop. And I would love, love, love to have you in my new docuseries, Anunnaki Ancient Secrets Revealed. We've got to get you here in America from Australia over to the studio in California so that we can record and get you in the docuseries.
Oh, I would love to do that. I'd love to do that. And I think what I find exciting about the Anunnaki narratives is so many people are discovering them for the first time right now. Mm-hmm. The information has been out there since the, 1830s, when we started translating the Mesopotamian cuneiforms. Mm-hmm. Now it's beginning to get into the mainstream through work like yours. And one of my ambitions, and I know I share it with you, is to be a gateway guy for people into this kind of information. And my background in the church means I'm a gateway guy for a lot of people who come from a faith background and who just need that little bit of an encouragement and permission giving to say, yeah, you can come here, have a look around. There are some amazing things to be found. Mm-hmm. And I do find that when we get onto the Anunnaki territory and realize these are not religious texts, these are not texts that are asking you to do anything or believe anything in particular, we realize how empowering these stories are in terms of how we understand the world and then how we conduct ourselves as human beings in the world. It invites us on an amazing journey of discovery.
Yes, absolutely. You said it. You hit it on the head, man. I'm looking forward to doing this workshop with you. Everyone, if you can't click the link in the live chat because it went by so fast, I'll drop it one more time. But also, the link is in the caption of this video. So just go to the caption of the video, click on that link, register for the workshop. If it's something that you feel like you want to be, that you're passionate about, that you want to learn more about, more in depth than just a surface discussion, even though we go deep in these discussions, but I'm talking about really getting into the root of this information. If that's something you want to spend 6 hours with us in an in-depth knowledge training workshop, a masterclass, then that link is in the live chat. The link is in the caption or in the audio of this video. I look forward to seeing you and talk to you again, Paul. Tell everyone where they can find you.
Likewise. You can find me at fifthkind.tv. My website, my personal website is paulanthonywallace.com. There's the Paul Wallace channel on YouTube as well. And you can find all my books. That's Escaping from Eden, The Scars of Eden, Echoes of Eden, The Eden Conspiracy, and The Invasion of Eden at Amazon and on Kindle.
Amazing. Amazing. Looking forward to seeing you guys. This has been Paul Wallace. Make sure you follow him. Make sure you get his books. They're amazing books. I've got to get the newest book that he's got out. And you heard it here first. We're going to get Paul Wallace on Anunnaki. If you haven't seen the series yet, make sure you guys go to the 4BK TV app by going to your app store and getting the Forbidden Knowledge with the number 4, Forbidden Knowledge TV app, and watch episode 1 and episode 2 of the docuseries, Anunnaki Ancient Secrets Revealed. The entire first season is done, filmed, and edited, and getting ready to be released. We put up 2 episodes so far. The rest of the episodes are coming out, and I'm getting ready to start filming season 2 very soon. So it's going to be amazing. All right, Paul, thank you, man. We appreciate you guys, and I'll see you later.
Thanks, Billy.